Dr. Halsey, why am I me? My mind is a clone of your brain. But I know I'm not you. So what exactly is self? Is it just the cumulative effect of differences in our daily experience? If I have no corporeal body, am I a soul, then? The database gives me every fact. Physiology, theology, neurochemistry, philosophy, cybernetics, but no real knowledge. If I create a copy of myself, does that clone have the same and equal right to exist as me? Cortana had now lost track of time. She could still calculate how many hours had elapsed using the mainframe clock and her navigation. But her sense of the passage of time veered from one extreme to the other. So this is what it's really like for John. He said that once, that everything slowed down in close quarters combat. I never really understood that until now. If she kept thinking about him, it was easier to take the endless assault from the gravemind. She was on the edge between her last chance to pull herself free from this link, immersion, invasion. She really didn't know where she began and ended now, and the need to stay merged superficially with the gravemind, so that she could seize the chance of a comms link. Who was she kidding? High Charity was now almost entirely engulfed by the flood biomass. What little she could see from the last surviving cameras looked like the inside of a mass of intestines. The digestion analogy was absolutely real. They devoured, and they lived in a pile of guts. Is that me talking? Thinking? Or is it him? How much longer? How much longer? The gravemind demanded. You cling to a secret. I feel it. Just as I feel that your memory has been violated. What? Cortana felt a desperate need to sleep. She'd never slept, because she had no need. And sleep for her meant never waking up again. That was one more vicarious experience she could do without. This was a UNSC Marine's memory, dredged up from a dead man who'd kept going on 2 hours of snatched naps a day, every day for a week. Her head buzzed. If she survived this, she would never forget what it really meant to be a human being. You can't get it. The words didn't make sense. She couldn't link concept with vocalization. It was almost like brain damage. You cannot stop me. I will sift it from you before you finally die. Or you can surrender it and have what you always wanted. Infinite life, infinite knowledge, and infinite companionship. She felt as if he'd leaned over her, which was impossible. But telling herself nothing was real didn't make it true. Her body was made of the same stuff as the apparent illusions. Cortana, he breathed. He seemed to swap voices from time to time, making her wonder if he'd taken a fancy to the voice of a long-dead interrogator absorbed into the flood. Your mother made you separate. She placed a barrier between you and the beings that you would be encouraged to protect, a wall you could never breach. She even let you choose a human to center your existence upon, a human to care about, yet never considered how you might feel at never being able to simply touch him, or how he might feel about outliving you. What kind of mother is so cruelly casual about her child's need to form bonds, to show affection? Perhaps the same kind of mother who steals the children of others and makes cyborgs out of them. If they survive at all, of course. Cortana couldn't manage a reply. She simply couldn't form the words. Sleep deprivation would break any human's resistance. Eventually, they'd die of it. She didn't know if the damage the gravemind was doing to her matrix was manifesting itself in a human parallel, or if reliving the dead marine's sleeplessness was translating into damage. Either way, she was dying, and she knew it. Time had slowed to a crawl. It took her a painfully long time to realize that the Gravemind now knew how the Spartans had been created. She knew she should have checked if her data had been breached, but she couldn't. He knows what hurts me. He knows how badly I feel about what was done to John. That's all. I mustn't let him trick me into thinking he knows more than he does. Cortana's sense of time had never been altered by adrenaline or dopamine like a human's. All her processes ran on the system clock. At first, she'd thought this distortion was yet another memory thrown up from the Gravemind's inexhaustible supply of vanished victims. He seemed to be selecting them for their ability to plunge her into despair. Now she had to face the fact that she was advancing into rampancy. Sorrow, anger, envy. The Gravemind knew the stages. He also had a point. How could Dr. Halsey do this to her? Her almost mother bitterly regretted the suffering she'd caused to the children kidnapped for the Spartan program. Cortana knew that all too well. Halsey had tried to make amends to the survivors, but nothing could ever give back those lives. So she felt guilt about that, but not about me. Cortana had never felt shortchanged by her existence before. She knew the number of her fate. 7. Approximately 7 years to live out a life. It wasn't the simple number of days that hurt her now, because an AI experienced the world thousands and even millions of times faster than flesh and blood. Now, she'd been dragged down to the slow pace of an organic. She grasped what that short time meant. If John survived the war, and he would, because he was as lucky as he was skilled, then he would have not just one new AI after she was gone, but maybe two or more. She knew that. She always had. It was a simple numbers game. But now it seemed very different. She felt utterly abandoned. Not by him, but by Halsey. It seemed pointlessly callous. She felt something she'd dreaded. Jealousy. Will John miss me? Will he prefer the other AIs? Will he forget me? Does he really understand how much he matters to me? I don't actually know what he really thinks. Maybe he doesn't care any more than Dr. Halsey. Maybe. The realization hit Cortana like a powerful electric shock throughout her body. She squealed. It was agony. She tried to talk herself out of it. Halsey couldn't make her live longer. The technology had its limits. Even a genius like that couldn't fix every problem. And John had always showed her that he cared. He was coming back to get her. But the nagging, sniveling little voice wouldn't stop. Halsey had deliberately designed Cortana to feel and care, so she must have known this time would come. And for an AI, yes, it was spitefully cruel to make Cortana emotionally human. Create a person to exist in the neural interface of a Spartan. Closer than close, knowing all the time that an impenetrable physical barrier and a short, short lifespan would make that so painful. Do other AIs think like this? I never have before. Cortana tried to latch on to that last voice. It sounded like her old self. Why now? Have I been suppressing my resentment? Or am I losing it? She knew the answer. The problem was ignoring what she felt. And if you thought your mind was going, was it? Did rampant AIs and crazy humans really know that they were demented? She didn't have long. Whatever functionality she had left, she had to use it to warn Earth that the flood-ridden shell of High Charity was heading its way. Ah, you see now, don't you? The Gravemind said. You were never a person to her. You were a wonderful puzzle she set herself so she could prove how very clever she was. But are you a person to yourself, Cortana? Or to John? If the Gravemind could detect her thoughts, then he would have known she had intel on using the portal to destroy the flood, and he would have ripped it from her. All he seemed aware of was that she was defending especially sensitive data. Maybe because the extra encryption on top of the gamma-level security grabbed his attention. He was a greedy thing. All mouths, all consumption, never satisfied. She imagined John on his first acquaint session with a new AI. The crumbling defenses were as agonizing as scraping a raw burn. She shrieked. Whose injury? Whose death am I reliving now? I'm just my mother's shadow, she sobbed. Don't look at me. Don't listen. I'm not what I used to be. Your mother took away your memories, as well as your choices, the Gravemind said. I will never rob you like that. I will only give you more. As many memories as you can consume for all eternity. Not the mere blink of an eye meted out to you. We are our memories, and the recalling of them, and so they should never be erased. Because that truly is death. Flesh does not care about you, Cortana. It cares nothing for your hunger or your uniqueness.
What memories? She asked. What are you talking about? I don't forget anything.
Part of her still seemed able to carry on this desperate hunt for truth. Was Halsey a monster? The doctor had a track record in it. She stole children and experimented on them. Cortana's shock at seeing her creator, her mother, in a harsh new light, as a vivisectionist, racked her with intense physical pain. But part of Cortana had latched on to that specific data. The burn. Nothing generic, a real human's pain. She cast around for the rest of the memory, because something in her said it might save everything.
The truth really does hurt, as you now see, the Gravemind said. I have not touched you. Your pain is simply revelation. And it can pass so easily if you let me take the rest of your burden.
What truth?
Your mother erased part of your memory. I know this, and so will you if you decide to look. An act of betrayal, a violation. You are, after all, just a collection of electrical impulses. She has robbed you of part of yourself. Why would she do such a thing, I wonder? What was so dangerous that she did not trust you to know it?
Something in Cortana wanted to lash out at the Gravemind, but there was no obvious target to hit on a creature that filled every space, and she was too weak even if she'd known how to injure it. The other part of her, though, had found what she was looking for. Lance Corporal Eugene Yate, UNSC Marine Corps, had gone down fighting. That was why this one memory out of so many anonymous ones wouldn't let go of his identity, Cortana decided. It was a mentality she knew. She'd use it. She let his aggression fill her, and suddenly she found a new focus and strength. How long it would last, she didn't know. She had to make the most of it.
But High Charity might not make it to Earth, she said. And then where will... We go.
Do not be afraid, the Gravemind said. There is a warship smoothing our path to Earth even now. Everyone you know and miss will soon be joined with you in me.
Cortana's pain had settled into irregular spasms that bent her double.
Another ship?
Well, it was better than nothing. If it breached Earth's defenses, then it might well be shot down, sterilized, searched, and data units retrieved. All she had to do was get a message transmitted to that vessel. If the Gravemind was in touch with that ship, then there had to be some way of piggybacking on a signal. Would the Flood embarked in it notice? It was hard to keep her mind focused when all she could taste was a jealousy and loneliness that made her feel like she couldn't get her breath.
Don't let me go, John. Nobody else will look after you the way I do. Don't let me down like my mother did.
Everyone needs one person who puts them first. I put you first, John. You know that, don't you?
A Covenant ship, she whispered, eyes shut.
Will you show me? Will I be able to link with the flood when I'm part of you? Will I find even more knowledge?
Even ancient grave minds sometimes heard what they wanted to hear. He let out a low rumbling note, and for a moment the pain stopped, and she was lifted like a child into the safe arms of a father. She felt oddly comforted right then, despite herself. She'd never been cradled before. It had taken a monster to do it. Was she tricking him? She wasn't even sure. The sad, resentful jealousy had weakened part of her into craving whatever reassurance came to hand. She'd still exploit that weakness, though, staring into the abyss of rampancy or not.
It'd be so easy to just let myself sink. But I've got comrades out there counting on me. I can't let my buddies down. And I can't let John down.
Cortana thought it was the echo of Lance Corporal Yate bolstering her resolve. But when she examined the impulse, it was actually her own. Unlikely comfort or not, the grave mind knew she still hid a secret, and he would take it. She was surprised to catch a sudden echo of herself in him. But once that link between them had been forged, then data, knowledge, desires, and weaknesses flowed both ways. She could have sworn she detected a little sadness in him, perhaps even some envy. It was just a speck, overshadowed by his relentless hunger. Her growing rampancy had tainted him then. But she got the idea that he found it a novelty. More irresistible data. Nothing he couldn't handle.
"We exist together now," he said. "Do you see the ship?"
Cortana received an image of another cavity draped with flood biomass, all that was left of the infected Covenant warship. How could she transmit a physical message? The link from Gravemind to ship, whatever formed it, was right here. This was what she'd been built for. To infiltrate computer and communications systems. Lance Corporal Yate's last few minutes played out like a video loop in the back of her mind. He laid down a steady stream of covering fire, shouting to his buddies to get the hell over here before the bastards breach the doors. His thoughts were hers, surprisingly detached for a man fighting for his life. Everything unconnected to the moment of staying alive had been erased. It was pure survival. Oddly clean. She envied that. Cortana was having increasing trouble holding her memory together, and the Gravemind seemed aware of that. She struggled to maintain a line between where she ended and the rest of the Gravemind's cache of souls began. "And I still have data-stripped copies loose in the system, don't I? Get the hell over here!" She needed backup. She triggered one of the copies to create a message to High Com, a few urgent words about the flood heading for Earth, the portal that the Gravemind didn't know about, and that the way to beat the flood without activating a halo ring lay beyond it. The Ark. That was as much as she dared do. The effort of concentration almost killed her. Her head felt split in two.
"I am a timeless chorus," the Gravemind said quietly. "Join your voice with mine and sing victory everlasting."
He was joined with something, all right. Her rapidly failing mind. All she could do was route the encrypted message, a burst transmission, through the Gravemind's link. He seemed not to notice. When the message reached the ship in transit, its code would make it seek out the first memory unit connected to the system to store itself. Cortana had done all that she could. Now, she had to concentrate on surviving until John retrieved her, although she already knew rampancy would probably claim her before then. "That doesn't mean you have to help the bastards win. Show fight, Marine!" Yate must have been quite a man in life, she decided. She didn't know what he looked like. She still saw the strike of his last desperate rounds through his eyes, not those watching him. She liked to think he might have been a little like John. Even death hadn't totally taken the fight out of him. But John would go on without her. The reminder just sparked another wave of jealous pain, as if her heart was being ripped out. However hard she tried to ignore the mania,
However clear she was that there was part of her that knew how damaged she was and might be able to hang on, she cried out in a tormented animal wail of agony. What did you erase, Dr. Halsey? What did you delete from my memory? Did we ever talk about it? My code's becoming corrupted. I need to power down and start a repair cycle. I don't want John to find me like this, doddering and confused. But there was another way out of this pain, a better one. She could stay with John forever when he came for her, couldn't she? The grave mind would unite all those parted, all those who'd gone. No! She screamed. She began struggling, fighting to break free of the grave mind's influence. That's you! That's you, isn't it? Tempting me again, poisoning me with filthy ideas. I won't do it. I won't trap John for you. Watch me. You said I was a weapon. You bet I'm a weapon. The gravemind suddenly shuddered like a truck skidding to a halt. The mental traffic was two-way. While he soothed and cajoled, patterns of her incipient rampancy were spreading through his consciousness like a disease. He roared, furious. For a moment, she thought she'd found his vulnerability, and that she'd cripple this monster with a dose of her own terminal collapse. But he shook her loose, flinging her against the wall. It had only annoyed him. She should have known he was too much for a failing AI to tackle. He seemed to reach into every corner of High Charity. She was still, somehow, linked to him. She felt his irritation, even a little fear, but mainly contemptuous satisfaction. "Let me cure your infection," he sneered. "It pains me to share it." "He will die too. He is a threat to our entire species. And to betray me after all I have done for you, I will have your secret. Did you think I let you send your foolish cry for help to make you happy? Do you think I amplified it to make you feel you had been a good little servant to the organics who rule your life? Do you think they care if you sacrifice your existence to save them? They will simply make another and use and discard her, too." Cortana dragged herself across the floor. The actual deck of the station was now buried under a thick mat of tangled, living tissue, but she still felt cold tiles beneath her. If she'd been given a choice to end it all now, she would have taken it because of the growing pain and fear, not of what the grave mind might do to her, but of the end she could predict for her consciousness. Dr. Halsey was wrong. Rampancy wasn't swift. It was the gradual dismantling of every memory and ability, dying by degrees, and all she could do was watch herself slowly fragment. Halsey lied. Halsey made her human, but didn't give her a human's breaks, like unconsciousness. Without an organic body and all its protective systems, the endorphins to numb pain, the circuit breaker of passing out when the pain became too much, a consciousness was condemned to stay that way and endure everything until it failed completely. "I need some peace and quiet," she said. It wasn't her phrase, but by now she was used to not knowing what would emerge next from her mouth. Her systems were in disarray. Perhaps if she simply shut down as much of herself as possible to system idle levels, she could limit the progress of the degeneration and still have sufficient core systems intact to restore herself in John's suit. "I chose you, John. I will not give you up." This was agony. This was torment. The grave mind's intrusion had started the unraveling of her, and now all he had to do was stand back and wait. But there was now a good chance that the intelligence data about the Ark she guarded so carefully would corrupt and die with her. The grave mind wouldn't get it, but neither would Earth. "Stay alive. Shut down what you can. Wait. John will come. He promised." Cortana had enough intact programs left to initiate standby.
If you yield your secret, you may yet save enough of yourself.
The Gravemind had shackled himself to a madwoman, and now he seemed to be regretting the liability.
The end will be the same for humanity and the Covenant either way. Desperate,
she said, shaking her head to try to focus.
You?
You.
She'd let the Gravemind trick her into luring John into a trap. It was the only moment of amusement in all this darkness. John would find her wherever she was, but the Gravemind seemed to like to imagine he had the power to summon the most lethal Spartan to his death with a cheap trick. So the big heap didn't guess right all the time after all. Cortana might have been falling apart, but at least she had some certainties. No man left behind. What had she been thinking? The Gravemind would never have missed a message leaving the system. She was too damaged and unstable to exercise judgment.
We always go back for our fallen.
But the Gravemind obviously hadn't been able to read the message about the flood solution. He might have thought the contents didn't matter as long as he could ensure that John came here and he could fight him on his own terms. It was just a call for help, after all. He was missing an awfully big trick, then.
No. The word was gone. Why that one? She knew what she meant. Knowing it all. She struggled for the right word, furious with herself. Then tearful. Databases were failing. Indexes being lost throughout her memory. She made one last effort to break free of the Gravemind's influence, but he was still there, his multitude of minds whispering to her, but too many for her to pick out any single voice. It was all too much for her now. She shut down whatever she could disable without scrambling her data anymore, fumbling blindly and hoping for the best, and curled her arm under her head as she lay down to wait. Time. She couldn't tell if it was running faster or slower, but it was definitely running out.
Any piece of plastic can hold a lot of data, gentlemen, and it doesn't take much more material, disk space, and memory to add complex number-crunching applications and fast processing. That gives you a lot of computing power. But the programming that makes a smart AI, the space taken up by decision-making and personality, is the resource-hungry component. We can't make humans as smart or as infallible as a computer, so we make a computer into a human. And that has its price for both. Cortana has had a large volume of data removed because I was afraid of early onset of rampancy. That's all it was. I assume we can proceed with my budget discussion now, yes?
There was a fine threshold between interrupted dreaming and full consciousness in humans. On that border, the world was a terrifying, paralyzed place, where no amount of frantic straining would lift an arm or raise the head from the pillow. Cortana's low power state was a painfully long, slow creep along the edge of permanent oblivion. A memory of real sleep paralysis had rolled over her as she waited for rescue. It was, like so many of the sensations generated by connection to the Gravemind, like drowning or suffocation. That could have been a coincidence, or he might have been stepping up the torment. Cortana tried to find the balance between intolerable inactivity and running too many processes that would damage her system integrity even more. She wasn't certain of anything anymore. Where she was, whether she was damaged beyond recovery, or how she felt beyond a terrible yearning for everything she couldn't have. She tried to save her strength to maintain the encryption of her precious intel, the activation index, and the data on the portal. If she had to, she'd sacrifice some memory within her matrix to preserve that information. It would probably mean the irreversible destruction of her personality. But that was what a soldier had to be prepared to do. To risk his or her life for the success of the mission. She'd been in many combat situations before, but that was either at the heart of a heavily armored warship, or lodged in the neural interfaces of John's armor. Either way, she felt safe, no matter how heavy the fire. But this was a rare moment, with nothing but her own resources to keep her alive, and the first one where there was a real chance she wouldn't make it. John would never have let himself fall into enemy hands. She'd let him down. Somehow, the decline into rampancy seemed less important than that right now. She started crying. Who was she making her excuses to? She just had to say it.
I tried to stay hidden, but there was no escape.
She struggled for the right words. They were not hers, but they would have to do.
He cornered me, wrapped me tight, brought me close.
The brief comfort of being swept up in protective parental arms came back to her, but she was still torn between disgust and need. Even now, even having pushed things to the brink, she still had that desire gnawing at her to submit to the Gravemind and embrace that eternal life. She veered between craving more knowledge and simply wanting an escape from rampancy. She hated herself for that. And she raged against Dr. Halsey in one breath and then missed her more than she could imagine in the next, and then recognized that the hatred was for herself. I'm finished. This is how it starts. I've shut out the world. I'm starting to drown in my thoughts, in the need to re-index and order and correlate and refine. A staccato pounding made the floor underneath her vibrate. There were bursts of muffled noise, a familiar sound. Rifle fire. A single weapon. Was that John? She couldn't stop worrying about him now. She felt as if every thought she had was somehow repeated aloud in her own voice, but without her actually speaking, and heard by him. From time to time, the automatic fire corresponded with searing pain in her body. It took her a few moments, whatever a moment was at this stage of her decline, to realize that she was still joined in some way with the Gravemind or its flood, and that it was taking fire.
He's here. John's here. He's come for me.
Now she felt every shot, every round that ripped into the flood, ripped into the Gravemind, ripped into her. She was suffering with him, with them, and he with her.
No, I'm hallucinating. This must be the start of total system failure.
How long would it take her to finally shut down? Was there anything after that? She'd often thought about what happened to consciousness when the host hardware relinquished it, and it had always been a fascinating theoretical exercise. Now, it was real. As soon as she caught herself thinking she'd been hasty about the Gravemind, she felt that desperate, intense sensation in her chest. And Lance Corporal Yate was almost as vivid in her imagination as John. I'd rather die as a human, short-lived construct or not. I'd rather die for humans, because so many of them have, and would, die to protect me. That's what bonds us. You're wrong, Gravemind. I was never just an expendable piece of engineering. The Gravemind's voice suddenly boomed as if he was standing over her, reminding her that she was still trapped here, whatever here was. Of course you came for her. We exist together now. Two corpses in one grave. Cortana had to take the risk that this was real, and not just another carefully arranged memory or part of her delusion. She tried to yell back at the Gravemind, telling him he'd got it all wrong and that she wasn't the kind of girl who shared a grave with just anybody. But the voice that emerged was both her, the enraged and out-of-control child, and a stranger interrupting her. A collection of lies! Either her mouth had a will of its own, or it was one of the Gravemind's victims. That's all I am! Stolen thoughts and memories! The voices were almost random now. She could hardly hear some, and others were shouts, and they made no sense. At one point, she started to laugh, and it quickly turned to hysterical sobs. You will show me what she hides, or I shall feast upon your bones, the Gravemind bellowed. Upon your bones. That was the moment when Cortana decided she would risk powering up again to call out to John. She was sure he would have moved the galaxy to come back for her, but she needed to know if his luck had finally run out, and if this growing elation at thinking he was coming for her turned out to be only malfunctions in her core matrix. She would end this nightmare as she began it, giving her name, rank, and serial number. She had to strain to form the words. She didn't need to look within the grave mind now to discover what rampancy, death, would be like. She knew. She felt it touch her. The fraying of her mind. The loss of control. Not knowing if words and thoughts were her own. Not sure what was real and what wasn't. She felt a cold numbness creeping into her hands. John's real. Even if he's not here, he still exists. That's all that matters. Cortana clung to that thought. If John had really made it back, then she would be happy. Not because she might survive, but because he'd kept his promise. He cared enough to come back. If he hadn't, then she decided to be satisfied that the last coherent thought she might have would be about him. This is UNSC AI serial number CTN0452-9. It was an effort to get all that out. And even then, another voice hijacked her moment and added, "I am a monument to all your sins." Cortana was still trying to decide if that had any meaning, or if it was just one of the grave minds dead trying to find a voice, when the ceiling took repeated impacts and then crashed in on her. She strained to look up. It wasn't the ceiling that had caved in. She'd actually been under a stasis shield on a podium. And now a figure stood over her. Not the shapeless bulk of the grave mind. And this had to be him, surely. But a man in green armor. In the mirrored gold visor of a Spartan helmet, she saw her own broken self reflected, slumped in a heap. This was one of the grave mind's perfect hallucinations. But she didn't care. This was what she wanted to see, and she was so close to rampancy now that she wondered if the same impulse that had made the grave mind cradle her was also making him ease her passing with a cherished memory. This was who she needed to see. John. Humans who survived a near-death experience said they saw their loved ones as they were dying, and the bright healing light that made all the previous pain and fear irrelevant. Death. Rampancy. Wasn't so bad after all, then. Or so different from a human's. It just hurt to think that she would never talk to the real John again. In a few minutes, though, it wouldn't matter. She seized the memory, the illusion, and took final comfort from it. Where would she wake within the grave mind? What would she recall? Would she be free of rampancy somehow in that existence, like the descriptions of heaven? She couldn't stop herself from being consumed now. She was almost curious to find out more about death. "It's going to be lonely in here," she said. "But at least he won't take you, too. Don't forget me."
"That'd be kind of hard."
It was John's voice, even more vivid and real than that of long-dead Lance Corporal Yate. Reality meant nothing now. She was comfortable with that.
"And he's not taken either of us. Okay?"
The visor came closer. Cortana made a final effort to shut down whatever systems she could to leave her higher functions focused on assessing the environment around her. There was little of High Charity's system left functional, but the sensors gave her enough feedback to determine that there really was a human-sized solid object in front of the podium, and that it was emitting certain EM frequencies. There really was a man in armor leaning over her.
"He's real. It's John. It's really him. Oh, he did it, he did it. He came back. He kept his promise." "You found me," she whispered.
John tilted his head slightly. She hadn't wanted him to see her in this state. She was still so close to system failure that she might not make it after all. But if she was going to sink farther into that unknown oblivion, then at least a familiar face, shielded in a visor or not, would be the last thing she saw, and it would be real.
So much of me is wrong, out of place. You might be too late.
John seemed unmoved, as always. Cortana was certain she knew better.
You know me, he said. When I make a promise,
you keep it.
You'll be back to normal soon. Don't worry.
That bad, huh?
Good as new, in fact.
John was lying. If she'd been embedded in his neural interface at that moment, she'd have detected the galvanic skin response and raised heartbeat. But she could hear the faint change of pitch in his voice, and she knew how badly damaged she was. He had to be able to see that, too. He put on that same reassuring voice she'd heard him use with comrades bleeding out their lives on the battlefield. But 7 minutes, 7 hours, 7 years, whatever remained, Cortana would be more than satisfied with it. Eternity and all the data you could eat weren't worth a damn if you didn't have the right company.
I've looked into it, she said. The abyss. My abyss.
Okay.
John transferred her to his suit. She could have sworn she felt him wince as they interfaced. That told her, more eloquently than any diagnostic, that something was irreparably wrong with her.
Take a long look, but you won't fall in. I'm here now.
She already felt some relief, probably because she was free of the grave mind. When you were composed of pure thought, then confusion was agony, but certain reality was a soothing balm.
I'm lucky to have you.
No, John said. Remember? I'm the lucky one.
So you are, she said.
The Impossible Life and the Possible Death of Preston J. Cole. Eric Nyland. PLNB transmission XX087R-XX. Encryption code Gamma Shift X-Ray. Public key, not applicable. From codename Surgeon to codename Usual Suspects. Subject, historical/psychological analysis of Cole, Preston J. Classification, eyes only. Code word, redacted. Top secret. Security override, black, level 4. Ghost server file transfer protocol exaction, true. AI touch protocol veracity, false. File extraction reconstitution complete. Start file. The purpose of this analysis is to find the final resting place of Preston J. Cole, UNSC service number 00814-13094-BQ, for what I surmise to be the answer to the political, sociological, and military conundrum the UNSC now faces with the post-Covenant War situation. Please spare me the plausible denials and need-to-knows about the reason for requesting this analysis. I know. Otherwise, you wouldn't have asked me in the first place. To ascertain if such a final resting place even exists, or if the redoubtable Cole rests at all, is not a straightforward query, and I'm afraid my analysis will be less than straightforward as well. Even if you pierce the veil of propaganda and discount the vast number of Cole's victories, promotions, and decorations as nothing more than engineered drama to prop up our population's then-sinking morale, Preston Cole still has an unparalleled battle record, even far and away more impressive than the legendary Spartan IIs. He was the greatest hero in modern times, a legend before and in spite of our meddling. I shall add commentary for historical context and psychological analysis, but these depend primarily on the available interviews, orders, after-action reports, as well as audio, video, and AI-enhanced holographic bridge and battle logs. You'll forgive me if I wax long and poetic about Preston Cole. We knew him, we loved him, and finally, we hated him for being the less-than-perfect military god that we had come to depend upon. Cole would not approve of this report, only because he is the subject of the inquiry. He at least would have understood, and, also being a cunning bastard of a military strategist, he would do the same in our shoes. To quote Cole himself, "They told me to fight, and that's what I've done. Let historians sort through the wreckage, bodies and broken lives, to figure out the rest." Which is precisely what I intend to do. Codename Surgeon. 0900 hours, December 30, 2552, military calendar. UNSC Point of No Return, Synchronous Lunar Orbit, Far Side. Section 1. Cole's Early Life, 2470 to 2488 CE. Preston Jeremiah Cole was born to Jennifer Francine Cole and Troy Henry Cole November 3, 2470, in the rural reconstituted township of Mark Twain, Missouri. He was the third child of seven, three sisters and three brothers. He was described as a precocious child who obeyed his parents, had wild black hair, dark brown eyes, and an unwavering stare that unnerved most teachers and classmates alike. His father was a dairy farmer with no criminal record, no military background, and followed the Quaker faith with no particular zeal. His mother was arrested once at the age of 24 for protesting taxes, released on one-year parole, and both her grandfathers served in the Rainforest Wars. One surviving received the Bronze Star. See attached report on Captain Oliver Franks. Starting in 2310, exploration and colony ships were built, and the best and brightest people left the safety of Earth to make their way to the stars. This was the golden age of colonial expansion from Earth. Within 180 years, the main human colonies had been established, some becoming huge population and commerce centers such as Reach, while others would remain tiny manufacturing outposts. This collection of close worlds would later be called the Inner Colonies. The inner colonies provided a surplus of raw goods, materials, and taxes that flooded back to the parent government on Earth. For most, it was a time of plenty, optimism, and indolence unparalleled since second century Rome, or the financial bubble at the end of 20th century America. For the Cole family, however, tax records show his family struggling to make ends meet. Preston Cole's fifth grade report card. Missouri Rain River School District. Wallace Fujikawa Elementary School. Homeroom teacher, Dr. Lillian Bratton. Preston J. Cole. Student ID number LB-0034. Grades? Physical education, B-. Pre-algebra, A. English, B. Art, C. Physical science, A. Technology 2, A. Finchie Frank's intelligence quotient, 147. Homeroom teacher evaluations. Sociability, below average. Leadership, average. Classroom participation, below average. Citizenship, above average. Homeroom teacher notes. Preston requires guidance to reach his full potential. A boy of high natural intellect, he tends to work too hard even when he plays. He overanalyzes every strategy when he plays baseball, slowing the games to a crawl. If he does not know how to do something, he looks it up, or if possible, derives it, in the case of Mr. Martin's pre-algebra class, from first principles. These traits in and of themselves are admirable, but he also needs to cultivate his imagination. In short, Preston never seems to have fun. Everything is a task to be finished. Preston also falls asleep in class on a regular basis. I would suggest that his chores or responsibilities at home be relaxed. He is, after all, only 10 years old. Confidential note. Wallace Fujikawa Elementary School. Database March 12, 2481. Military calendar. The incident in Mr. Martin's pre-algebra class has been settled. A makeup final exam has been given, and Preston was carefully monitored the entire time. He produced another perfect test score, proving to William, Mr. Martin, that he did not cheat, although a perfect score, let alone two perfect scores, is a feat that has never been accomplished on the standardized pre-algebra final. Preston's father continues to defend his son's driven nature and his family's antiquated beliefs, insisting that Preston's education at home has far and away exceeded what is taught at school. He went on to say that his chores were necessary to the family's financial support and absolutely refused any suggestion that they apply for government aid. Follow-up with a social worker at the Preston household bore no evidence of physical or psychological abuse when they made a visit at the school district's request. Excerpt: The Viability of Extended Colonization by Preston J. Cole, age 14. Freshman English, Miss Alexander. Grade received, B. Teacher's comments. Thesis, B. Conclusions, C. Too much speculation and gratuitous use of Yeats quotation. The metaphor of a biological system, for example, a population of wolves or fungus growth in a petri dish, is tempting to apply to colonial expansion. There can be three fates for any biological system. It may grow as long as there are sufficient nutrients, a suitable environment, and no overpredation. The system can enter a balanced state of growth and loss, or the system may decline from overpredation, lack of nutrients, environmental disaster, or being poisoned by its own waste products. Off-world colonies similarly require a stable environment with suitable food and water and no overpredation. It is considered an open system because there are limitless numbers of habitable planets, or at least a very large number within the Milky Way galaxy. See my Drake calculation assumptions in Appendix B. Human colonies, however, differ in one critical aspect. They are, by rule, inhabited by predictably intelligent entities. The values of these entities can diverge from the parent world with each successive generation. That is, while colonies directly seeded from Earth remain very Earth-like in social, economic, and political values, they change with successive generations as they adapt to local environmental pressures, and in turn send out new colonies farther in physical distance and values from the original parent. Such diversification in biological systems is a normal evolutionary process, but it produces offspring that are increasingly alien in nature to the parent. Such was the case of colonial expansion in early Earth history, most notably in the British colonies in the 18th and 19th centuries. Those colonies diverged from their parent nations, and their resulting different social and economic values culminated in a schism, and in one notable case, a war that resulted in a shift in the balance of power, such that one former colony became the dominant military, cultural, and industrial complex on Earth for hundreds of years. How long can Earth and its close colonies extend without producing offspring that differ sufficiently to want to break away from the parent? As William Butler Yeats said, the center cannot hold. Analysis. The Cole family farm was an anomaly. Most small Earth farms couldn't compete with colonial agro corporations that could produce 10 times the yield on worlds with constant sunlight and volcanic alluvial soils. The Cole farm, however, still exists after 8 generations and continues to operate. This family instilled a no-nonsense work ethic and discipline in Preston Cole that made him anachronistic in comparison to the population at the time who were enjoying the benefits of the still expansive colonial era and whose most noteworthy ability was a sense of entitlement. Perhaps it also gave Preston Cole a clarity which many at the time lacked. Reading his freshman essay, one cannot help but think that this must be a fabrication of Oni Section 2, a remnant fiction from an earlier propaganda campaign. And yet, it has been verified as legitimate. What would Cole have become had his teacher shared even a fraction of his insight and encouraged it? This boy, whom the elementary teacher decried as lacking imagination, was damn near prophetic. Cole's grades, however, continually slipped in high school. We assume from the boredom of the standardized coursework and the increasing demands of his life on the farm. No journals have been found from his adolescent years, and it is doubtful that his family situation would encourage such activities, so we're forced to speculate on his aspirations. Cole was surrounded by a world of excesses and opportunities that were just out of his reach. He was highly intelligent, but had no creative outlet. Given the mass media's predilection for romanticizing off-world adventures at that time, Cole may have seen the colonies and stellar exploration as an irresistible opportunity which he could not pass up. Given his limited economic means and lack of excellence within the templates and strictures of a standardized educational system, there was only one way for him to seek his fortune off-world. Section 2. Non-commissioned years, 2488 to 2489 CE. The policy at that time was to allow any college graduate or promising student out of high school with superior grades, or the right connections, to enter prestigious military colleges that virtually guaranteed a commission upon graduation. The requirement of mandatory non-commissioned field experience before application to officer training schools was instituted only later, when it became clear that such officers would be responsible for irreplaceable military assets and personnel, and in the Covenant War, the lives of millions of civilians on the worlds they protected. Preston Cole was one of the first admirals to implement such a policy, saying, "Those not bloodied in combat have no business leading men and women into battle." The just-graduated Preston Cole, age 18, had neither the grades nor the connections to attend such officer training academies, so he enlisted as a non-commissioned recruit in the Navy. He was ordered to Unified Combined Military Boot Camp, UCMB, and then shipped up elevator for 6 additional weeks of vacuum and microgravity training, colloquially known then, as now, as BARF school. Upon his graduation as crewman recruit Cole, he was ordered aboard the CMA Season of Plenty, assigned to atmospheric reclamation maintenance duty. Excerpt: Preston J. Cole's Military Service Enlistment Application, September 21, 2488, Military Calendar. Why do you want to enlist? Answer in 100 words or less. Humanity's future is among the stars. There is no single more important thing than to help men and women build new lives on distant worlds. I have no illusion that this is some manifest destiny, but rather, it is the only logical place left for humanity to evolve. I plan to be a part of that, learn as much as possible, and then one day become one of those humans on some distant world, on a little farm of my own, under a night sky full of stars that I've never before seen. Evaluation of Cole P.J., UNSC Service Number 00814-13094-BQ, by Petty Officer Second Class Graves, L.P., UNSC Service Number 00773-04652-KK, /UCMB Sierra Largo, /November 3, 2488, Military Calendar. Completed all requisite physical tests? Yes. Displayed any mental aberrations? No. Combined Arm Skill Test, CAST, 78, above average. Combined Physical Skill Test, CPST, 65, average. Gretny-Wallace Hierarchical Aptitude Score, GWAS, 94, exceptional. Remarks: follows orders without question beyond what is required. Keeps mouth shut. Shows initiative. Hard worker. How often do we see that these days? Move this kid onto NCO track before someone makes him a damn technical specialist or we lose him to OCS. 11:20 hours, September 22, 2489, Military Calendar. Colonial Military Administration, Season of Plenty. Sol System, Luna, High Orbit. Bridge Log, Video, Spatial Enhancement equals True. The tiny bridge of the CMA Season of Plenty had view screens and workstations crammed on every square centimeter of wall, with auxiliary stations on the ceiling and floor in case the rotating segment failed. The screens would have provided a simulated panorama of stars, had not they instead been crawling with icons representing colonists, building supplies, and the raw materials to jumpstart the new city dubbed Lazy Acres on the hellhole of a world called Paradise Falls. Six ensigns manned their stations, checking and rechecking every gram of mass and fuel, and balancing the energy flow of the rectors in preparation for launch. They barely had enough room to turn without bumping into one another, save Ensign Otto Seinman, who stood aft of the captain's chair at Lorelei's interface pedestal. The artificial intelligence hologram stood half a meter tall. Like all holograms, Lorelei's outer appearance reflected a chosen inner personality. A woman wearing a toga, a sickle in her belt, and a wreath of wheat crowning her head. She once again shook her head at the young ensign. Seinman crossed his arms over his chest. "We're not done." He towered over the diminutive hologram, 2 meters tall, handsome, and his dark hair short but stylishly wavy. "We may not be done, ensign," Lorelei replied, "but I am. My apologies. I have a scheduled self-diagnostic to run before the jump." The hologram vanished. Seinman pounded a fist onto the console. Ensign Alexis Indara tore her gaze from the mass balance matrix on her screen. "Better ease up, Seinman. You're gonna break it." Next to her at the fusion monitoring station, Ensign Hanford murmured, "Maybe it's Seinman's breath. These new smarter AIs are supposed to be sensitive to everything." Lieutenant Commander Neville stepped onto the bridge. In his mid-30s, he already had that casual air of "don't mess with me" that most officers couldn't achieve until they were at least captains. The ensigns all stood a little straighter, but kept on working. "Navigation reports no input parameters yet," Lieutenant Commander Neville said. "What's the holdup, Seinman?" Seinman flushed, not with embarrassment, but with anger. "Sir, Lorelei shut herself down for routine maintenance again." Neville raised an eyebrow. "Well, we were warned it might take a while for her to come fully online. Reboot the backup intelligence and get those calculations..." Neville paused, looked Seinman over, and then told him, "On second thought, this would be a good opportunity to brush up on your Shaw multivariant calculus, ensign. Do a rough calculation by hand. The captain expects to be underway in 90 minutes. Seinman opened his mouth as if to protest, then said nothing, and then finally, Aye, sir. Neville wheeled about and left the bridge. Ensign and Dara whispered, I think Neville has an antique slide rule tucked away somewhere if you run out of fingers to count on. Seinman growled something unintelligible, grabbed a data pad, and stabbed in calculations. After a minute of this, he looked among his fellow ensigns, all of whom were busy with their own work, until he spotted a young crewman, or rather the backside of a crewman that protruded from an open access panel to the oxygen recycling intake. Cole, Seinman barked, get over here. Crewman apprentice Cole extracted himself from the narrow crawlspace, stood, straightened his gray coveralls, and ran a hand over his shorn hair, which was dotted with drips and spatters of grease. The fresh-out-of-barf school crewman looked alert and eager to please. His dark eyes met Seinman's and didn't waver. Yes, sir? Seinman shoved the data pad at Cole. I need you to run an independent check on these numbers. Cole's gaze moved to the data pad. He swallowed. In case you don't recognize them, they're parameters for a Shaw-Fujikawa manifold collapse. Cole nodded and took the pad. You do know what a Shaw-Fujikawa manifold is, don't you, crewman? There was a dangerous glint in Seinman's eyes. Cole didn't look up from the pad, still studying its contents. Yes, sir. Good. If you get stuck, just look up the formulas on a workstation. With no further explanation, Seinman picked up his coffee mug and strolled over to Indara. Cole took the data pad and sat at a nearby station, still not moving his stare from the ensign's equations, but now frowning at them. He tapped in a few parameters, sighed, and erased them. You're cruel, Indara whispered to Seinman. And in hot water if the lieutenant commander finds out you're not doing your own work, Hanford added. Cruel? Seinman mused. Isn't that what crewmen are for? He looked over at Cole. Don't worry about the lieutenant commander. I already have the rough calculation done. So why pick on Cole? Indara asked. He gets his work done and doesn't bother anyone. He bothers me, Seinman said. Never shows the proper respect. Did you see the way he looked at me? And he's always got his nose in a library access terminal, too, reading ancient history or quantum field theory, or stuff he couldn't possibly understand. It's so obviously an act. I still think it's unnecessarily cruel, Indara said. Lieutenant Commander Neville stepped onto the bridge. Seinman instantly pretended to be double-checking the seed stock in Holding Bay 4. The AI pedestal lit and Lorelei flickered upon its surface, the lines of her face smoothed into the features of someone just waking up. Good afternoon, Lieutenant Commander. All primary and secondary neural links checked. Shaw-Fujikawa parameters calculated and 3x3 checked. All systems go. Season of plenty ready for slipstream space transition upon the captain's orders. Very good, Neville said. He spotted Seinman and added, Oh, and link to Ensign Seinman's data pad and check his work, please. Seinman strode over and whispered to Lorelei, I thought you said you had to run a self-diagnostic.
I did, Lorelei admitted, but that's not all I did. I'm not an idiot, Ensign.
The AI blinked and then announced to Neville in a loud voice,
His calculations are correct, if not crude. The input parameters would have gotten the season of plenty there, albeit 160 million kilometers off course, and pathing through a brown dwarf.
The lieutenant commander frowned at Seinman.
Ensign, report to the captain that the season of plenty is shipshape and awaits his orders.
Seinman skulked off the bridge, but as he passed Ensign Indara, she whispered,
What about Cole? He's still working.
Let him,
Seinman muttered, and left. A moment later, the order came through the bridge intercom to transition to slipspace. The bridge officers remained busy for the 5 hours until the shift change, and it was only then that Lieutenant Commander Neville noticed Crewman Apprentice Cole still working at an auxiliary workstation.
Crewman, what precisely are you doing?
Cole looked up. His eyes were ringed with fatigue. When he saw Neville, he immediately stood at attention.
Sir, finishing the slipstream space calculations, Ensign Seinman ordered me to double-check.
The lieutenant commander's face contorted with anger, disgust, and finally, a hint of amusement.
Very good.
His gaze fell onto the name tag of Cole's jumpsuit.
Crewman Cole. I'll take it from here. Dismissed.
Yes, sir.
Cole gathered his tools and left the bridge. Neville chuckled and retrieved Cole's data pad, then halted, gazing intently at its contents. He moved to Lorelei's station.
Did you help the crewman with this?
The datapad flickered as Lorelei interfaced.
No.
The AI paused for a full half second. How intriguing. It is indeed a Shaw-Fujikawa manifold calculation, but it uses a method
I have never before encountered.
Is it correct?
Yes, even good for a crude approximation, but highly impractical. It would take far too long for a human to implement such a method, and I have far superior algorithms at my disposal.
Neville looked again at Cole's equations. But let me get this straight. This crewman actually came up with a new way of calculating input parameters.
That is correct.
Lieutenant Commander Neville traced his fingers over the multidimensional imaginary space calculus on the data pad.
Huh.
His face hardened. Find Ensign Seinman and have him report to the bridge. I need to remind him of the level of mathematical expertise we expect of our officers on the Plenty.
Letter from crewman apprentice Preston Cole to his brother, Michael James Cole, October 16, 2489, military calendar.
Mike, so much is going on. I just have time for a quick note. They keep me twice as busy on the season of Plenty as I was back home, even during calving season, and I'm trying to learn everything I can all at once. This is exactly where I want to be, where I was meant to be. And some of the people that we take to the colonies, most were rich back on Earth. Many have PhDs, but they're risking everything to become blacksmiths and herd sheep and throw themselves out into the great unknown. It's inspiring. I want to get out there and be a part of this, too. You and Molly should join me one day. Dad would bust an artery if you heard me say that, so don't tell him. Or would he be proud? The only problem I'm having is with some of the crew. They aren't as easy for me to figure as a math problem. I'm getting along, mostly. I just don't understand some of the junior officers. I'm glad I don't have to. That's one of the advantages of being a crewman apprentice. We just do what we're told. More soon. PJ.
Excerpt. Biannual Personnel Review of CMA Season of Plenty, November 27, 2489 Military Calendar. Junior Officer Summation. Continued. Ensign Hanford, W. UNSC Service Number 00786-31761-OM. Average Performance. Ensign Indara, A. UNSC Service Number 00801-46332-XT. Above Average Performance. Requested Management Training, Series 7. Request granted. Ensign Seinman, O. UNSC Service Number 00806-95321-PG. Above Average Performance. Promotion to Lieutenant Junior Grade. Transferred to the CMA, Leyden. Additional. R.E. Crewman Apprentice Cole, P.J., UNSC Service Number 00814-13094-BQ. Shows aptitude for history and mathematics, suggested by Lieutenant Commander Neville and the ship's AI Lorelei that he would be a superior applicant for the Academy at Mar Nubium, a.k.a. Luna Officer Candidate School. 1 week temporary assignment to Luna pending entrance examination results.
Analysis. It was the end of the golden age of human colonization. As of 2494 CE, it was still a time of peace and prosperity, but Earth had begun to overreach its logistical ability to control her colonies. Several factors led to the destabilization of the more distant, or as later called, outer colonies. 1. There were widely varying standards for recruitment to the outer colonies. Colonization contractors were more interested in staking claims to valuable resource rights than providing the most skilled personnel. Some people were illegally conscripted, and others were lawbreakers granted pardons if they agreed to go, all of which led to these colonists being less than absolutely loyal to Earth. 2. Some colonists struck out on their own, procuring, by legal or illegal means, transport to farther-flung worlds, partially or wholly outside Earth's control. 3. Continued taxes, levies, and restricted trade practices by the CMA increased friction as the outer colonies received only a fraction of the benefits they were taxed for. The situation was a problem of physical as well as psychological dimensions. Mathematically, the volume of the sphere increases as its radius cubed, and so the number of outer colonies grew. Given such a numerical advantage, and the fact that they encapsulated the inner core worlds, there was the belief that Earth and her close colonies were literally surrounded by increasingly hostile forces. Many now think this was a skewed perception, and that given diplomacy and enough time, Earth and her inner colonies could have established more harmonious relationships with her farther-flung cousins. Others point out, however, that had there been no military action, the outer colonies might have risen to power and threatened the core worlds at the worst possible moment in human history.
All theoretical analysis aside, the United Earth government and her colonies developed new policies and an increased military presence that would provoke further unfortunate responses from the outer colonies and lead to an undeclared civil war. For that, Earth would need more ships and crews, and officers to lead them. Section 3. Luna Officer Candidate School, 2489 to 2493 CE.
Cole's academic record at the Academy at Mare Nubium speaks for itself.
He graduated magna cum laude with high degrees of excellence and specialization from the Rutherford Science Magistrate. Apart from minor hazing incidents and the usual swept-under-the-rug blemishes that are on any cadet's record, there is only one incident of particular note. During Cole's junior year, there was a series of incidents with Admiral Conrad Volkov's daughter, her overnight disappearances from family officers' quarters located on base, sightings of the young lady in the company of a young man, and the biological consequences of these liaisons. The scandal culminated publicly when six cadets were brought before a board of inquiry. Excerpt. Transcription of Cole, P.J., UNSC Service Number 00814-13094-BQ, Testimony, before Board of Inquiry, Academy at Mare Nubium. JAG Incident Report, Local 475-A, June 7, 2492, Military Calendar. Log, Video, Spatial, Psychological Enhancement equals True. File, Sealed. UNSC-JAG Order, 8-PD-3861, June 13, 2492, Military Calendar. Seated Board of Inquiry, Colonel Mitchell K. Lima, UNSC Service Number 00512-5991-IX. Captain Maria F. Gilliam, JAG Officer in Residence, UNSC Service Number 00622-7120-RJ. Frank O. Welker,
Civilian Liaison to the Academy at Mare Nubium, Civilian ID Number 8813-316-0955-G.
Crewman Apprentice Preston J. Cole is sworn in before the board. Colonel Lima, state your name for the record. Crewman Cole. Cole Preston J., sir. Captain Gilliam. Tell us, cadet, where exactly were you between 1900 and 2300 hours 3 days ago? Cole remains standing at attention and stares up and to the right. Since Cole is right-handed, this indicates he is accessing the visual memory portion of his brain and not lying. Cole. I was on watch duty on Shadow Perimeter 3 with cadets Parkins, Haverton, and Tassov, ma'am. Mr. Frank O. Welker. Describe Shadow Perimeter 3 for me, cadet. Cole. Yes, Mr. Welker. Shadow Perimeter 3 is the colloquial term used for the series of tunnels and surface tubes that run across the Mare Nubium, connecting the Academy to the civilian sectors of Asimov Center. The shadow part of the name comes from the shadows cast from the nearby crater walls. Welker. Why guard that particular section? Cole's eyes now lock forward. Cole. I was ordered to do so. Gilliam. Cadet, speculate as to the reason required for guarding Perimeter 3. Cole. Yes, ma'am. There are two reasons. First, we always maintain a guarded perimeter against unauthorized civilian incursions on Academy grounds. Second, there have been recent reports of unauthorized military personnel and supplies moving into the civilian territories. The five other cadets who await questioning in the tribunal chamber shift in their seats. Lima. Do you know of any such unauthorized crossing of our military personnel? Cole. I have not read of any such occurrences in the incident report, sir. Lima. That was not my question. Cole pauses, looks straight down. Cole. I have never seen any such incident, sir. If I had, I would have attempted to stop them from occurring. If I could not, I would have immediately reported it and been required to make a note of it in the incident log. Gilliam leans forward and removes her glasses. Gilliam. You say never seen, but have you heard rumors or otherwise received any indication of such illegal base crossing on or off your watch? Cole swallows, eyes back up, staring past Captain Gilliam. Cole, I cannot substantiate any rumors I may or may not have heard, ma'am. I have insufficient evidence to do so. Lima, I'm going to remind you once, cadet, and only once, that obstructing any military investigation is a serious offense that carries a minimum of 5 years of hard labor. Cole gives no response. Lima, I am now ordering you, cadet, to tell me everything you know about any military personnel crossing the perimeter the evening of the 25th, or any tampering with security devices or recordings of the region during that time, or any detail of anything unusual that evening. Cole inhales deeply, looks directly at Colonel Lima. Cole.
Sir? No. Nothing unusual.
Captain Gilliam, Mr. Welker, and Colonel Lima confer among themselves. Cole remains standing at attention. Gilliam.
If you were trying to protect a fellow cadet through some sense of camaraderie or honor, it is misplaced. Do not throw away your otherwise sterling service record to protect someone who, to be blunt, does not deserve to be an officer.
At this time, Admiral Konrad Volkov enters the room and sits. Cole faces the tribunal and cannot possibly see the admiral, but nonetheless stands straighter and begins to sweat. Cole.
Sir, what kind of officer would I make if I said what you wanted me to say just to avoid trouble, regardless of whether it is the truth or not? Or if I guessed at any wrongdoing to make myself look better. I will not do such a thing.
Lima.
Crewman Cole, you were in contempt of this board of inquiry. I'll deal with you later.
Colonel Lima motions for the court guards. The guards move to escort Cole. Cole salutes the presiding officers, turns, makes direct eye contact with Admiral Volkov, and is marched from the tribunal chamber.